tear those mountains down.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland. I am Joe Clement, your host and engineer today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The Old Mole is a political magazine for the radio. We consider ourselves socialists and feminists and anarchists and agitators of the working class for a glorious future where we don't have to work as much, where people are not oppressed by outrageous expectations of hierarchy and dependency, and the earth is looking like it will survive. On today's show, we're going to be hearing from Bill Resnick and Rob Wallace. They're going to be talking about a couple books of his about the effects of capitalism on agriculture and the neoliberal approach to agriculture. Desiree Helligers is going to be talking with Ramon Ramirez of Pacoon about recent raids you may have or may not have heard about conducted by the Immigration Office of the Federal Government, ICE, just outside of Woodburn. They're going to be talking about the action or the events itself and what we can be doing to support immigrants, immigrant workers, and people of color in these trying times. Later in the show, Tom Becker is going to bring us a reading reminding us of the socialist and revolutionary workers' origins of International Women's Day, which is this Wednesday. And to wrap up our show, Todd Sloan will be talking with his guest about psychology in the Trump era. We're going to get right into it with Bill Resnick and his interview with Rob Wallace.
Hi, Rob Wallace. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. It was a pleasure to be here.
Rob Wallace is an evolutionary biologist. His books are Big Farms, Make Big Flu, also Neoliberal Ebola. He studied a host of new viral disease epidemics recently emerging, bird flu, MERS, Ebola, Zika. He studied the diseases and outbreaks and concluded that epidemics are the product of the agribusiness Big Farm Everywhere revolution. Rob will be speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church, downtown Southwest 12th in Salmon, tonight, March 6th at 7 p.m. It's free. He also discusses a solution that would protect us, a rapid move towards global agroecology, which is, of course, a very different model of farming. Rob, how did you come to study the link between big farming and disease origins?
Well, I'm an evolutionary biologist by training, and at some point I was tasked to look at the genetics of a new bird flu at the turn of the century, H5N1, and we were able to make some evolutionary trees, family trees of the virus, and from that be able to figure out how the virus spread from place to place. The thing is, I got curious. I wanted to know why the virus emerged in southern China in 1997. And no matter how much you look at the genetic sequences of the virus, it doesn't tell you that. So I turned to looking at the economic geography of agriculture in the region. I looked at the history of agriculture in China and then moved into looking and studying the global spread of this particular livestock revolution model of production, which I concluded seems to have a big foundational impact on the evolution and spread of all the new pathogens that you listed.
Let's get into your findings a little bit more. How it is this new farming leads to epidemics. Some of these viruses that you found, in fact, all of them seem to have infected humans for who knows how long, thousands of years, but they never became epidemics. Why don't you talk about that?
Post-World War II, agriculture underwent what's called the livestock revolution, where it began to integrate all the modes and nodes of animal production under one company's roof. So from fertilization all the way up to meat packing. And that led to the consolidation of all these smallholder farms and led to the increase in the number of animals being produced here, primarily to start off in the United States. Well, that model of production has now begun to spread around the world. And what that means is you have a reduction in the diversity of animals and an increase in the number of animals and the increase in number of animals housed in each barn. So we're up to 15,000 turkeys per barn or 250,000 egg layers, chickens in a barn. And that has a profound effect on the evolution of the pathogens that circulate there. So a pathogen previously would have been capped on how dangerous it could be because it would have to evolve in such a way that it couldn't just knock its host out because it needs to be able to spread to the next host. But if you have a barn of 15,000 turkeys, that removes a cap on how dangerous a virus can be. And so the virus is able to burn through the barn at no cost to itself. So that selects for strains that are much more dangerous. And those strains are able from there to be able to pass off into the workers that are working.
Right.
With
and the animals that have it reproduce in some sort of way, but often with genetic changes so that the pathogen becomes more and more serious. And what you're doing is creating more and more dangerous pathogens. My understanding is that you also looked at that model. It's not only that there are more big farms than the U.S. agricultural model of agribusinesses, especially as to meat, but there's a hugely expanded meat eating now over the world. And those huge farms are now, in fact, because they're running out of land in the U.S. It's also in Africa, Indonesia, everywhere. They are cutting down the forests and building these monoculture of the crops that feed the meat or palm oil that feeds other things. They're cutting down the forests and forcing people into the big cities. There's a whole neoliberalism is sort of has the impact on the land is enormous, which leads then to the epidemics that come out of these big barns.
I mean, what you're getting is all the complicated interactions between the political economy and the economics, global economics, and its impact on agriculture, both here in the United States and abroad. So you have some pathogens like influenza, like MERS, like Salmonella that directly come off these mega farms that are being produced for the reasons we just discussed, the reducing diversity and also increasing number of animals that are being raised. On the other hand, you have the second set of pathogens that are emerging that are primarily coming out of some of the processes that you just described, where in the course of looking for more land to produce monoculture agriculture, whether it's animals or crops, many of the international companies, many of the multinationals are moving to the global south and taking land from smallholders and deforesting the local forests as a way of finding the land necessary to raise these animals and these crops. And what that does is that changes the ecologies of the local areas. So previously, say for Ebola, Ebola would spill over in Central Africa and West Africa and maybe hit a town or a local guerrilla troop, and it's a terrible thing, it's a terrible disease. But when you turn the forest into a monoculture, you turn a very complex ecology that blocks pathogens from lining up the susceptibles it needs to make an epidemic. And all of a sudden, a complex system becomes very simple. And many of the hosts will die, and many of the pathogens that they carry will die, but some pathogens will succeed. And so, for instance, for Ebola, the virus reservoir seems to be these frugivore bats. Well, the bats, when you remove their forest, they're just not going to roll over and die. They are attracted to many of the monoculture crops that are cash crops that are being developed, including palm oil. I mean, what's not to like? They have protection. They have food. They don't have any predators. They have nice space between plants to allow them to fly to from their roosting sites for the foraging sites. So some of these hosts are able to prosper under those conditions, and so that increases the interface between humans and the bat reservoirs. And that increases the rate of transmission of Ebola. And so neoliberalism has an effect both on the monoculture development and also the structural adjustment that removes the public health infrastructure necessary to stomp down an outbreak like Ebola.
And you get epidemics. That's what you're going to be talking about tonight at the First Unitarian Church in more detail. This was somewhat technical, but if you want to hear this story in 45 minutes, it becomes a lot more vivid. One final thing that you'll be talking about are the solutions. And the solutions are to radically change agriculture, it seems to me, in many ways. Why don't you just go into that in fairly briefly?
Sure. I always joke, well, half joke, that agribusiness is bringing America together, because I think people across the board despise agribusiness, even people who work for agribusiness. So the people who object to the way the animals are treated, they're on animal rights grounds, people who object to the lack of nutrition in the food, so they're the foodies who oppose to it. I happen to be an epidemiologist who sees that this is the perfect way to grow the next pathogen that kills a billion people.
Right. And there's also, of course, the global warming impacts of this, which is going to kill us before the epidemics, maybe. This is really the race to the bottom.
Right. So in some ways, there's some hope in the sense that so many people object to the way food is being produced this way, and it really gives us a sense of common interest. And so people can converge together to work for different agriculture. And that would be, as you mentioned, in many ways, depending on the crop and depending on the livestock, new kind of agroecology that, in essence, gets the economics of our production integrated back with the ecology of the landscape in which we grow our food.
Well, Rob, I think we've done it, actually. Let's, though, announce once more your talk tonight at the First Unitarian Church. It's at Southwest 12th and Salmon tonight, March 6th at 7 p.m. Rob Wallace talking about...
I'm talking about big farms that make big flus and other diseases. So come on down. It'll be a great conversation.
And unhealthy food as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And... warm the planet, which makes a lot of the pathogens are really happy.
Yes.
Thank you very much for talking to us, Rob.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
And see you tonight.
He was one of those dogged old men who live in the past, telling stories you don't want to know about how it was then. The hunger, the hardship, the hopes and the struggles of so long ago. And we must have looked bored, for like sparks from the cinders, his eyes glowed with anger, his words seemed to burn. He said, I will be heard, for my life is not over. I've something to say yet, you've something to learn. He said, you who have nothing at all to believe in, for you whose motto is money comes first, who are you to tell us that our lives have been wasted and all that we fought for has turned into dust? I was only a lad when we read that in Russia the workers, the Soviets, had taken all power, and the man they called Lenin who led them was our inspiration. His triumph was our finest hour, and I'll always remember how fear shook the wealthy, like thieves who have just been caught out in their crime. But we, who had known only war and the workhouse, rejoiced that a new world was born at that time. You can't know what it meant, and the pride that we felt to know working people, people like us, could shake off the shackles, could topple the palaces, remake the world without ruler or boss. It was this kept us going, this dream of a new world, through all those dark years of defeat and
You are listening to KBOO Portland, the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was a little Leon Rosselson song of the old communist. Did you know that the communist revolution, the Russian Revolution in 1917, actually began much earlier in the year than the famous October Revolution? It began on International Women's Day with strikes and demands for food by women on International Women's Day. It used to be in February. They had a different kind of calendar back then. We now observe it on March 8th. Later in the show, Tom Becker will be reading a little bit more history about the origins of International Women's Day. Up next, Desiree Hellegers is going to be speaking with Ramon Ramirez of Picoon about recent raids by the federal government's immigration office, ICE, just outside of Woodburn.
So, Ramon, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me on your program.
So, on February 27th, there was an ICE raid out in Woodburn, and a number of farm workers were arrested. And can you speak a little bit about the impact of that raid and the broader climate under this new administration?
Raid actually had a really tremendous effect, a negative effect on our community. We had understood that the priority of the Trump administration was to go after criminals, people that had serious criminal issues. And in fact, I think what we've seen happen last week was that they're actually going after hardworking people. In the case of the raid that took place last week, they went after farm workers, you know, people that work day in and day out to put food on the table, the American people. These are people who are the backbone, backbone of the agricultural industry, $6 billion. So it had a tremendous effect on our community. There was a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety in the community. It's really becoming a police state where our families are really, really being devastated. People are not wanting to send their children to school. People are missing their doctor's appointments for fear that they're going to get apprehended. The local businesses are suffering after years and years of prosperity here. Woodburn is considered a mecca for some of the best Latino food in the state. And it's just heartbreaking to see that the local economy is going under because this guy's immigration policy. We're hearing a family of a mother of five has no criminal record being taken, you know, and deported. We had these case of these farm workers here who I believe that one of the individuals had a DUII about 5 years ago. Another one had one about 10 years ago. And give me a break. Those are the criminals that we're going after? You know, I spoke at a synagogue not too long ago, and this elderly couple, really elderly, told me that they really believe that we were headed towards another Nazi Germany. And that everything I had to say was reminiscence of their youth. And so that was really a come to Moses kind of moment for me that said, wow, this is where we've gotten to. Right. And we elected a fascist as president of the United States. Right. And we're allowing a police state in our country to materialize. And the resistance, there's some resistance, but there's not enough. And people of good conscience, people of goodwill, you know, have to come to the aid of immigrants, have to come to the aid of farm workers. These are folks that work hard to put food on our table. And yet the only thing we afford them is deportation. So, I mean, there's something wrong with that picture, and I think that people of all goodwill have to come together and start making some noise here.
Yeah, so just to kind of clarify the scope of Trump's executive orders on immigration, they put at risk of or prioritize for deportation anyone who's been convicted of a crime or who's actually been charged with a criminal offense. So they don't actually have to be convicted of anything, just charged. And this very sort of broad discretion that it affords ICE agents when it says that anyone who's at risk to public or national security at the discretion of the immigration agent.
Those are broad, broad rules that the ICE, especially in the federal government, has to go practically after anybody. In the case of the raid that happened in Woodburn, the two individuals were actually had a DUII years ago. And to me, that doesn't warrant, going after a whole community. I mean, they stopped people on 99E. They stopped another 99E is a major thoroughway. So, and you know, it's definitely racial profiling because these people, like, there was a van full of Latinos, you know, going to work, and they stopped them. And so they asked. We investigated the case thoroughly, and they asked the agents asked the if they knew this individual, and they said no. And then they asked them, well, where are you guys from? And that's the crux of the matter that we're doing right now is we're trying to educate the people. Just because you're stopped by ICE or by a federal agent, you don't have to give them your immigration status. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to a due process. You have the right to call an attorney. And so we're in a process right now. We've had three community forums here, and there's a number of forums that are being organized in this community to teach people what their rights are. In the case of this individual that was arrested a month ago up in Gresham, they have five U.S. citizen kids. Here in Woodburn, they arrested an individual about 3 weeks ago who they were looking for a relative, and they got him. And he has three U.S. citizen kids. He's lived here for 30 years. Had a DUII a number of years ago. And just because of that, you know, it's caused pain and suffering in the community. The kids are traumatized. They'll never be the same again. And so, you know, that's what one of the things that we're doing. We've been asked many times, well, what is it we can do? Well, one of the things we're doing is... we're asking people to come to these community forums to learn their rights. Also to educate their families about what to do in case of emergencies. there's a number of churches that are offering scholarships to get to help pay for passports for the kids so that they can start the process to document their roots in the state.
Can you talk a little bit about the impact of these raids on working conditions for farm workers and wages and the overall impact on labor conditions?
Well, you know, it's kind of early right now, but I can tell you that the number one thing that's happening is that people don't want to go to work. We don't know what the long-term effect it's gonna be on the agricultural community. I know that a number of farmers have come out publicly and said that this is just horrendous for the industry. The farming, we're just starting to pick up work here and pruning and the bulk of the work hasn't even started yet. But I can tell you that there's a lot of fear among the workers, which can lead to a lot of problems in terms of there's a sector of farm labor contractors out there that can prey on people. And we're anticipating that's going to happen. So, again, we're doing Know Your Rights trainings, but also educating people about they have legal rights also. So to watch out for abuses, to watch out for violations of minimum wage laws, wage theft, because those are certainly coming. And like I say, it's kind of early right now. I mean, the administration has been in office for about a month. And so in 1 month, this is the result. And they haven't even started. I mean, we're going to see increased money for deportation. They're going to hire more immigration and custom agents for deportation, for deportation proceedings. They're going to hire more agents to conduct raids. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. We're really worried that if the American people do not come to the aid of immigrants, then we're going to suffer mass deportations, violations, wholesale violations of human and civil rights. And, you know, the couple that I spoke to at the synagogue not too long ago were saying, you know, this is what we went through back in the 30s. You know, they were really young, but they witnessed this. They assured me that they were going to do everything they could within their power to make sure that they came to the aid of immigrants. But we need more than that.
Ramon, are there actions or events that you'd like to promote and get the word out about?
Well, there's several actions. I don't have the information in front of me right now, but certainly there's one on March 6th up in Portland in front of the ICE offices. That's one. There's a number of churches in the Portland metropolitan area that are preparing, how I can help my community. There is a 1-800 number that you can call to report raids. And then, you know, there's the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition up in Portland is conducting a number of Know Your Rights and how allies can be, you know, good allies in this cause. So I would just say, you know, stay tuned to KABU for mobilizations. I know that people are starting to talk about the mobilization for May 1st, which would hopefully be a massive outcry of protest against the Trump policies. And there's been little victories here and there. I know that mobilizations in a number of states like Texas, California, and Illinois has resulted in immigrants that have been arrested for no reason other than that they committed a minor crime, were put into deportation proceedings, and through protests, through letters of support, through marches, they were able to get these individuals out. So we can stop. We can stop Trump, but it's going to take a village. It's going to take all of us working together.
Can you talk a little bit more about the situation of the woman who's facing deportation, the woman with five kids, and if there's ways that people can specifically support?
Yeah, I don't have the specifics on her case but I know of the case. And I read about it in OPB actually, and other news services. That there was a woman whose husband was on his way to work, never had a criminal record, was pulled over by ICE agents, and as a result of his arrest, and now she's under deportation proceedings. That's a serious problem. And, you know, those kids are U.S. citizens, and it's just amazing that we could put a family through that. Through those emotional issues. I know what a deportation feels like. My sister's husband was deported when he was when my sister was 6 months pregnant, their first child. And I know the desperation, us trying to get money, trying to locate him, and he was traumatized. You know, he actually got deported and never came back. He's one of those individuals who had he was really traumatized and didn't want to go through those issues again. So as a result, you know, my sister basically became a single parent mother.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the case of Francisco Aguirre, who's was really under siege from ICE and took sanctuary in the church in Portland, and his son was so traumatized by that experience that
exactly.
In the aftermath he went back to El Salvador voluntarily
and he was killed
almost immediately.
Yeah, and so I mean a lot of these folks, the group that was arrested, the farm worker group that was arrested last Friday, were from Guatemala. And a number of them were actually released because they have pending deportation hearings. I happen to know a couple who came here to the office months ago from that group, and were telling me why they left Guatemala. And basically, the brother was being targeted by a gang, and so the two brothers, they left, and he was married. And had two kids, and so like they came up together, and they actually, when they crossed the border, turned themselves in, and then were given these immigration papers. This was a year and a half ago, but they were telling me why they came up here, and I asked them, you know, if you were making a decent wage and didn't have these issues of violence in your country, would you come here? And the answer was no. I mean, I love my hometown. I love my country, you know, but I have to survive. I have a young wife. I have two kids, and, you know, I can't put them at risk anymore. And so, and to a large extent, our economic and foreign policies towards countries like Mexico and Central America are causing illegal immigration. You know, we don't treat countries to the south as economic partners. We look at those countries as a way to exploit their natural resources and exploit their people that create the conditions that the reasons why people immigrate illegally into this country.
Well, yeah, and the U.S.'s support for death squad activity in Guatemala against labor unions, against human rights activities, was just so integral to destabilizing the country in El Salvador and throughout Central America.
Exactly. So, and this is something that the American people don't understand.
You've been listening to an interview with Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farmworkers Union, PECUN. This is the first in a two-part segment. The second half will run next week on the Old Mole Variety Hour between 9 and 10 a.m. There are two events today bearing on immigrants' rights. One is a March for a Permanent Home for Portland Day Laborers. That's hosted by FOS Workers' Rights Education Project. It begins at 10 a.m. and goes until 12 noon at 240 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard at the Day Labor Center there. The second event is at 4:30. It's the ICE Out of Oregon rally. It's being hosted by FOS Hispania Cambio Comunitario, and it runs from 4:30 to 6 p.m. People will be gathering at 4310 Southwest McAdam Avenue, and again, that's at 4:30. At 4310 Southwest McAdam Avenue. This has been Desiree Hollerich for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was a little Rebel Diaz in a version of that classic song, Which Side Are You On? And before that, Desiree Hellegers was talking with Ramon Ramirez in what is going to be a two-part interview. Tune in next week to hear the rest of their talk about ICE and what happened in Woodburn and what's happening across the country. Coming up, we are going to be hearing from Tom Becker, who's going to read about Clara Zetkin's and the origin of International Women's Day. And to wrap up our show, Todd Sloan is going to be talking about mental health in the Trump era.
As many of you are aware, March is Women's History Month. March 8th is Women's International Women's Day. Today I'm going to take a look at the origins of International Women's Day and the extraordinary woman who is credited as its founder, Clara Zetkin. In 1910, at the Second International Conference of Working Women held in Copenhagen, Clara Zetkin, a member of the German Socialist Democratic Party and comrade of Rosa Luxemburg, proposed that a special day be marked as a celebration of women's accomplishments and a press for women's rights. The first International Women's Day was held the very next year in 1911, on March 19th, not March 8th. This day was chosen because on that day during the Revolution of 1848, the Prussian king, Frederick Wilhelm IV, for the first time recognized the strength of the people and the prospect of a totalitarian uprising and promised, among other demands, the introduction of women's suffrage, a promise, by the way, on which he soon reneged. In 1913, International Women's Day was transferred to its current date of March 8th. Clara Zetkin was a remarkable woman whose name should be well known to everyone interested in the causes of feminism, socialism, and any social justice movement in general. The history I'm about to relay is taken mainly from A History of Their Own, Women in Europe from Prehistory to the Present, Volume 2, by Bonnie S. Anderson and Judith P. Zisner. Feminist socialists such as Clara Zetkin were a small minority within the European socialist parties who were sensitive to women's particular oppression and sought to balance feminism and socialism. Zetkin linked women's liberation with the success of socialism, saying that the involvement of the great mass of proletarian women in the emancipatory struggle of the proletariat is one of the preconditions for the victory of the socialist idea for the construction of a socialist society, end quote. In Imperial Germany, where women were barred from all political activity until 1908, feminist socialists created the largest working-class women's movement in Europe. In the process, they developed a strategy for feminist socialism, which proved the most successful in gaining women's rights within a party which, however radical, still remained largely opposed to women's independence and liberation. Women's low participation in socialism enabled feminist socialists to argue that recruiting working-class women necessitated the creation of institutions to make the movement more hospitable to women, such as a women's bureau, women's trade unions, and a women's newspaper. These institutions became bases for power within the Social Democratic Party. Treading the fine line between fighting for women and not threatening socialist unity, German feminist socialists established a position which was simultaneously Marxist and assertively feminist. As a leading theoretician, political fighter, and socialist radical, Clara Zetkin was responsible for developing the positions which became accepted first by the German Socialist Party and later by the Socialist Women's International, a loose association of which Zetkin was founder and leader. Zetkin was a representative of women workers at the meeting of the Second International in 1889. There she asserted that the socialist parties could not succeed without the support of women workers and that women workers could achieve their goal only through socialism. Zetkin became the editor of a women's newspaper, which she named Equality. In her first editorial, she firmly linked women's oppression to capitalism rather than to simple male dominance. Equality, she wrote, with good intentions, if not complete historical veracity, proceeds from the conviction that the final cause for the thousand-year-old inferior social position of the female sex is not to be sought in the statutory legislation made by men, but rather in the property relations determined by economic conditions, end quote. Zetkin has also tied feminism to socialism by rejecting the charge that feminism was a bourgeois issue. She consistently spoke and wrote against bourgeois women and their equal rights movement. She argued that any cross-feminist alliance was impossible and that feminism could only succeed through socialism. The struggle, she said, must be with the male of her class against the entire class of capitalism. But Zetkin's radical commitment was much broader than women's issues. In 1911, Zetkin joined with Rosa Luxemburg in attacking the leadership of the SPD for what they believed was a lack of commitment against German imperialism. And at the outbreak of the First World War, Zetkin broke with the SPD, along with Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, and others to form the Spartacus League, objecting to SPD's decision to support the German war effort. With the advent of the war, Zetkin and other revolutionaries such as Luxemburg and Liebknecht found themselves in a tiny minority. The majority of organized social democratic women, Zetkin wrote, have sunk to the position of defenders of the national fatherlands of the imperialist bourgeoisie. They competed with the ladies of the bourgeoisie in their chauvinistic ideas and behavior. They have given up their basic aim, the proletarian revolution, and have thus rendered themselves incapable of representing the day-to-day demands of proletarian women, end quote. Disillusioned by socialism's sellout, Zetlin became a founder of the German Communist Party, the KPD. Zetlin was elected to the Reichstag in 1920 as a member of the KPD and served on its central committee. A long-life anti-racist, she also took part in international protests against Jim Crow laws in the United States and campaigned against the conviction of the Scots Rule Boys. Her last public appearance came in August 1932, when she addressed the Reichstag in its last meeting before the Nazis took control of the German government. At the age of 75, as the oldest member of the Reichstag, she was honorary president and gave the opening address. She called for a united front of all workers to turn back fascism and denounced Hitler and the Nazis. She died the next year in 1933. These are the radical beginnings of International Women's Day and the history of the remarkable woman who founded it, Clara Zetlin. For this piece, I have drawn on the web pages of International Women's Day and Spartacus and Volume 2 of A History of Their Own, Women in Europe from Prehistory to the Present by Bonnie S. Anderson and Judith P. Zisner. I'm Tom Becker from Monday Morning Radio Zine and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We just heard Tom Becker reading about Clara Zetkin and International Women's Day. To wrap up our show, Todd Sloan is going to be joined by his guest Rebecca to talk about the mental health effects of living under Trump. Todd?
Good morning. We're in the studio today with Rebecca Hyman, who is a therapist, anti-oppression activist, writer, scholar, and is working on a book right now about trauma, oppression, and social change. We're going to talk about the emotional and mental health effects of living under the Trump administration in hopes of making better sense of these effects and exploring our responses to them. First of all, we need to recognize that millions of people in the U.S. had already been experiencing ongoing oppression, threats, and insecurity, violence in the society, some from the government's actions or inaction. And we also note that many more privileged people have been profoundly upset, disturbed, etc., by the election of Trump and the first moves of his administration. These are perhaps the likely allies for people who are going to be directly affected by violence and oppression of the new policies and so forth. And from those people, I've heard a lot in town lately, people talking about how they can't focus, they can't sleep, they're irritable with their loved ones or just feeling rage in general. Maybe drinking more than usual, maybe feeling depressed or numb, and their usual tasks that they do are feeling less meaningful. And to me, these sound like some of the things that people associate with the term trauma. And some of them even say, I'm traumatized by all this political stuff that's going on. So I'm curious, what can you share with us about all of this, these emotional, psychological responses to the Trump era from the perspective of a trauma specialist and activist?
Thank you so much for having me on the show and for asking this question. It's very dear to my heart. As you said, I just want to concur with the fact that that there's sort of two ongoing intersecting responses to this election and the ascendancy of this regime, one of which is a group of people who were less politically engaged and are finding themselves really shocked and overwhelmed and almost facing a sort of existential crisis in response to this. And then another group of folks who this election isn't a seismic change. It's if anything, it's a slight intensification or a ripping the blinders off of problems that have been, that go back to the founding of our republic. So I'm going to try to speak to both of those histories.
Great.
Today. And, you know, it's interesting that list of of, I'll just at least initially call them symptoms, that you're describing are things that are being written about in the media right now as sort of an emotional response to Trump or an emotional response to this existential discovery. And we're very used to thinking about emotional responses as something that happened at the level of the individual, that we are individually responsible for taking care of those problems, mm-hmm. and that probably the best place to go if you're going to go anywhere besides to your, you know, family or friends is to go to a therapist and talk about your symptoms, and you might get a diagnosis.
Or get some medication for it.
Or, you know, you might get told you have anxiety or depression or PTSD. And for me, it's not that I'm opposed to any of those things. They can all be helpful. Obviously, I work as a therapist, so I believe that it's helpful and useful. But one thing that's been very helpful for me, both as a clinician and as an individual, is to draw actually on research that I've been doing for this larger book project now for a number of years, which is, and going back to the social justice movements of the late 60s and early 70s that were rights-based generally, and the different strategies that both radical and reform approaches to activism at that time period took to violence and oppression. And one of the reasons that I find this very useful in thinking about trauma and emotions is that it takes us outside of this more medical model upon which therapy is sort of based, and the medical model tends to talk about an individual completely outside of its social context, what we call the universal body of medicine. So, you know, when you go to the doctor, for example, and that's, of course, the root of this model, and you tell a doctor that you have a cold, he's not going to ask you, if it's a male doctor, if you have a boy cold or a girl cold. He's going to tell you that you have a cold and, you know, give you some medicine for it. But when we're talking, from my point of view, about something like trauma or historical trauma or secondary trauma, to look at this sort of universal body, we lose immediately access to the way we are all located in relation to multiple intersecting lenses and lines of oppression and social location, like class, gender, race, sexual orientation.
And all of those are relations as well.
They are relations as well. And so for me, one of the things that's really useful about the way social justice activists in the 60s started to look at these emotions, right, was to take them not as purely an expression of an individual, right? So I might feel sad, I might feel disempowered, but my sadness and disempowerment is inextricable from my social location. So I may feel disempowered because my party didn't win the election, right? But truly, I'm feeling disempowered because I'm internalizing my own oppression in a particular way, and I'm having my disempowerment, my structural disempowerment, my own disenfranchisement magnified and refracted.
And just processing it within yourself rather than seeing it as connected to all the external relations.
Right. And part of my feeling of disempowerment for me is connected to folks in other identities and other forms of oppression also being disempowered and also being disenfranchised. So it's an augmentation and intensification for me of my own feelings. So to say to me, well, you should go by yourself and figure out the root of your sadness, to me, that's not going to be as helpful to me to say, like, okay, my feelings of sadness, my feelings of disempowerment are inextricable from the freedom or liberation or oppression of those around me. And one thing that I found really exciting about the social justice movements in the 60s and 70s is that they really harnessed this small group model. The feminists called it consciousness-raising groups, but the feminist movement took this structure from the New Left and from the civil rights movement. And the whole idea was that your individual feelings, your individual experience was there not so much to illuminate your own individual relationship to reality, but rather we got together in groups to use our individual experience to illuminate ideologies that produce violence.
So what do you mean by ideology in that, in this sense?
So in this sense, I'm using ideology to mean less a system of beliefs and more a set of social structures that are taken to be natural. So for example, the ideology of white supremacy was taken to be natural until nonviolent social change erupted in the eyes of the white power structure and made white supremacy more visible. So ideology to me is something that we only come into relationship to the fact that it's not natural when we start to push against it.
Got it. It's what we call the critical notion of ideology.
Yes. Right. And if we think about it, the small group process was fundamental in different ways to the civil rights, anti-war, feminist, and gay rights movements. They all were based on these small group structures. And veterans coming back from Vietnam were also using the rap group structure. They called it rap group. The feminists called it civil rights. But the idea behind the personal is political was to illuminate white supremacy, militarism, racism, patriarchy, heteronormativity, and homophobia. Right. Hmm. So we get together and we talk about our individual experience to illuminate these larger structures because they are creating the violence that is erupting. So in a way, this framework even diminishes Trump as an individual. Right. Trump is a vector of these larger ideologies of violence. And so whereas initially, this may sound like a disempowering approach to recognize how many different ideologies are constraining us. At the same time, what was beautiful, I think, about some of these social justice movements was that they created activist projects that were a hinge between the personal and the political. Mm-hmm. So if we think, for example, about the Feminist Clothesline Project, which I'll explain briefly, and the AIDS Quilt, they're both forms of social justice activism that begin with an individual, but not to illuminate that individual, but to take the individual as representative of an ideological framework. So the Clothesline Project, for people who don't know about it, is a clothesline which was chosen as a symbol of women's work, and people would decorate t-shirts based on the violence that they had experienced, domestic violence, rape, childhood sexual abuse. And then those shirts were hung on a line so that you could witness the juncture between the individual experience of sexual violence and a mass image of just how prevalent this violence is. And if you think about the AIDS quilt, again, right, the individual history of the person who died of AIDS, but if you think about the AIDS quilt being laid on the memorial, you know, the national monument, what that was like for people the first time they saw that.
Right. So there's, in all those cases, there's a linking of the what people are normally interpreting as personal and individual to the social and in a form of social action that addresses that issue as well and empowers in the process.
Exactly. Yeah. And the idea is of, again, understanding the root engine of violence to stop the violence. So we can, of course, it's necessary to talk about and to address trauma at the level of the individual. But if the individual who is themselves traumatized is also engaging in activism to stop the ultimate engine of violence, that can be a form of healing, a form of empowerment. And one thing that was really important to remember, which again, I think we can take inspiration from, is that small group process not only worked to help people understand and combat these systems of oppression, but they became a counterculture to the dominant culture. And so these small groups became a holding place where you could receive validation, justification, affirmation that what you were experiencing was indeed real, it was true, it was a form of violence, and that ideologies themselves are a form of violence.
Mm-hmm. So in this juncture these days, what do you see emerging that's sort of like the previous versions of these small groups, and I've seen lots of instances of meetup groups or indivisible groups and things like that. Are they sort of along the same line, or are they not quite the same from what you can tell?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think it's very interesting that Resist meetup group is only a few weeks old and yet seems to have taken off, and the indivisible groups. There's certainly, I think, a desire for people to get together. I think one thing that's worth paying attention to is, especially in this moment, one thing that's happening that's really exciting is that folks are getting active for the first time. So they're likely to focus very much on the end result. And so one thing I think we can learn from these social justice movements is to pay attention to the hinge between the individual and the action. So yes, focus on the action. Focus on organizing protests and calling your congressman or doing direct action, but also paying attention to, can you be using these groups as a way of validating and understanding your own experience, so that we don't fall into a belief that I hear a lot, which is, I can't engage in social activism because I have to work on my own emotions. And rather to say that social activism can be a form of healing and addressing our emotional needs.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And there's certainly lots of opportunities that have been announced on the Old Mole Variety Hour in the show today. And every week there's a list of actions that people can take. I want to thank Rebecca for sharing her wisdom today. We've been talking with Rebecca Hyman, therapist, writer, anti-oppression activist, scholar, and this has been Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Bill Resnick and Rob Wallace, talking about agriculture under capitalism, Desiree Helligers and Ramon Ramirez for talking about the ICE raids outside of Woodburn, Tom Becker for his reading about the history of International Women's Day, and Clara Zetkin, the socialist feminist who helped to launch it, and to Todd Sloan and his guest Rebecca for talking about the mental and emotional effects of living under Trump. You can listen to any segment or the whole show by tuning into kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in a couple days. We will post the show in individual segments for you to enjoy or share. You can also find links to other materials that we may have mentioned or found are useful. You can also listen to us next week and every week, Mondays, 9 to 10 a.m. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one today by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.